during the time of the World Abbots meeting in Thailand a month or so ago, one of the subjects of discussion that was on the table, on the agenda for us all to consider was what way can we best preserve Lumpur Cha's teaching. And a very interesting array of different answers, responses that the people came forth with. But one that was particularly striking and came to mind earlier today was a comment that Lumpur Sumato made, which was that one of the qualities that Ajahn Chah very actively cultivated and trained his monastic community in was what is called samana sanya, or the perceptions and attitudes of a samana, one who is a renunciate, one who has gone forth, or in ordinary parlance, an unworldly attitude, an attitude free from worldly concerns, not dominated by worldly influences. And that the samana sanya, as he described it and cultivated it, was based on contentment. It's a primary principle of renunciation, even though we tend to think of it in terms of a lifestyle or a commitment to 8 precepts or 10 precepts, 227 precepts, or just, you know, coming to the monastery and taking the 8 precepts on the observance day just for a limited period, that we think of renunciation as some kind of formal commitment or some kind of quality that has an external sign, external characteristics. But what was most striking, or the way that Lumpur was talking about it and how he reflected on that, you know, of all of the dozens of different things that one could consider of, you know, what's a best way or a significant way of preserving Lumpur Cha's teaching, and some people immediately started going to kind of fine points of veneer about, you know, one meal a day practice, this is, we should uphold this is eroding everywhere, and all these kind of things. Ajahn Sumato was talking of this more broad principle, or so what he was moved to bring up, and also the basic principle of the samana sanya of renunciation is its foundation is contentment. And gratitude, really, katanyuta. So that that quality of contentment, being grateful, being at ease with the way things are, at ease with what you've got, not being needy or dependent on a lot of things, is the external forms, taking the precepts, taking the steps of ordination, etc. These are formal declarations or ways of exhibiting that kind of commitment or intention. But more importantly, that quality is of samana sanya is an attitude within our hearts, within our minds. It's that very quality of contentment within us. That ease with the way things are. So the precepts that we take and the reflections that we follow are designed to support that and help to inculcate that and help us to develop that. So, for example, the reflections on the 4 requisites, and this is something that it's quite noticeable when you are around Ajahn Sumato very much, that not only does he teach Dhamma on an extremely sort of high and refined level, But it's also noticeable how often, along with his descriptions and his instructions on the refined strata of Dhamma, of ultimate reality and the means of awakening to that, as in equal measure, he will be talking about the four requisites. And you know, when he in years gone by, when he would be leading the chanting every day at Amravati or Chithurst, it was really noticeable how often he would choose to recite and lead the reflection on the four requisites: robes, alms, food, lodging, and medicine. And so that would seem to be, for some people, that was a strange counterpoint. You know, if his real concern is on the nature of ultimate reality, how come, you know, we do all these recollections about not for fun, not for pleasure, not for fattening, you know, not for beautification with the food, or reflections on our robes, you know, only to ward off heat and cold, sun and wind, burning and creeping things, only to remove the dangers from weather, and to be modest, and so forth. So that the reason why he outlined that in this way he was speaking at the meeting was really interesting, and Ida was actually found that very helpful. And sometimes you know the mind would tend to just sort of, oh well, it's just Lumpur doing his emphasis on the four requisites, but that's not really the important thing. The really important thing is realizing ultimate truth right here and now. But so that the mind that always wants the sort of, you know, the bestest, the most refined, the ultimatest, the most super duper high grade, five star, top quality, wants the best and the highest and the most intense and absolute. Well, it tends to push aside the sort of what seeming looks like a kind of basic or introductory or inconsequential element. But then, as you know, as time goes by, you know, you have to consider, if you're being wise, well, you know, Ajahn Sumedho has many things he could choose from to recite. Why does he keep choosing to recite and talk about the four requisites? Well, what we find is that, and what he pointed out at the meeting was that the more we truly develop that quality of contentment, we really reflect on what we need. Because it's easy enough to say, I'm not interested in robes and lodging and all that stuff, you know, it's not important to me. What's really important is ultimate truth and, you know, realization of the Dhamma, realization of Nibbana. That, you know, actually what one tends to do is to cultivate a whole repertoire of preferences and dependencies and articulated or unacknowledged needs in terms of the material world, in terms of the way we relate to the body, to our possessions, to our lodgings, and to food. And in a way, because the mind is aiming at sort of loftier things, we don't notice what the reactions are when you know, somebody takes the last good apple in front of us, or that the color of your robes isn't quite right, or the way that you feel about your room or your kuti, or you really like to move to a different place, or that this one needs fixing up, and that a whole array of preferences and judgments and dependencies get inked in, and when those get taken away from us, or changed, or somehow suffer some kind of detrimental change that's out of our control, we suddenly don't have a choice of where we're going to stay. We don't have our own room. Suddenly we have got to share our room, you know, our space with someone for a fortnight or a month or longer. Then what happens? You know, where does the ultimate reality go when suddenly you've got to share your room with someone? Like, he's doing it again. You know? He knows that that's where I always put my... my Dhamma book goes there. And, you know, we're ready to take up knives, or at least verbal knives, against each other. Not noticing, well, it's just a roof over the head for one night. That's all. It's just a shelter. There's nothing that, you know, I when I was ordained, I didn't undertake to, you know, to be guaranteed having my own space for the duration. And I would always have my own room. I'd never have to share with anyone else. That was not in the contract. And in fact, it's interesting, and this is something that Lumpur would also point out very regularly, is that when we take the full ordination, at the end of it, in the Anusasana, the section of instruction, after having gone forth and taken up the life of a bhikkhu as a samana, then the four supports are described. And so, and that's the deal that you make when you've gone forth, is that right there and then, sort of not even before you're 15 minutes into the bhikkhu life, there it is. You undertake to be content with rag robes. You can accept, you know, robes of cotton or silk or other fine materials, but scraps of thrown away cloth is what you agree to have as your standard. Alms food, whatever food happens to be given to you, whatever is dropped into your bowl, and you agree to that as your standard. You can accept, you know, fine foods, you can accept a banquet from wealthy people, you can accept invitations to people's houses, but the basic standard is whatever happens to land in your bowl from whoever feels inclined to offer anything that day, the bindabhata food. Similarly, with the lodging, you know, that you can live in a large building, or you can live in a small kuti, you can live in a cave, you can live in various different things. But the deal that you make on your ordination day, right after the sangha kamma is complete, the sangha act, the legal act of your upasampada is complete, is to live at the root of a tree. That's your basic standard. That's the standard of living that you agree to. And anything else is extra. If you do happen to have a place with a roof and a, you know, a door and a window, hey, great. If you happen to be sharing with 15 other people, well, so what? In the early years at Chithast, Ajahn Tanavaro and I were the two most newly ordained bhikkhus there, and we shared a 9x9 kuti for 18 months. We kind of slept at right angles to each other. Two people in a 9x9. We got very friendly. And it was absolutely fine. There was a dearth of living accommodations, and so we needed to share, so we shared. And then we shared a room in the house together. And then when we both ended up being at Harlem, we shared a room there as well. It was a normal thing to be doing. So, you know, first, after I came back from Thailand, that was the first 4 years of my monastic life in England, I never had my own space. It's normal at that time. And then medicine, you know, we politely translated as basic natural remedies in the when giving an explanation, but the Pali for the fundamental standard for medicine is that of fermented urine. It's basic and it's natural. But often it's considered to be a little bit too coarse for polite society in the West, and raises a few too many eyebrows. But that's the deal. And you can take ibuprofen, and you can take rescue remedy, and you can have all kinds of other medical treatments, operations, and vitamins, and tea, and honey, and fresh ground black coffee. These are all counted in the realm of medicines, but your basic deal that you sign on for is fermented urine, just ordinary urine. Vitamin P, as it's known in the trade. In certain circles. It's a very good medicine, so, just incidentally. But that's the deal that we agree to at our ordination, is I agree to train myself to be content with living at the root of a tree, just thrown away, discarded cloth, sewn together for robes, alms food to eat, and urine for medicine. And then anything else is extra. So that then, that's a very helpful psychological tool, because it's very easy for us to have high-minded aspirations and to be and to love the ideas of the Dhamma and the practice of the Dhamma, but that tends to be more sort of neocortex driven area of life. It's sort of the higher mind and the refined areas of consciousness. But the things that often drive the heart, and where the problems lie, is of the what we call the defilements, or the anusaya, the latent tendencies of becoming, of greed, of sense desire, of selfishness, and fear, of aversion. Those are way below the neocortex, down in the sort of reptile brain, the sort of the non-elevated, non-verbal subterranean, chthonic areas of the brain that want, hate, get away. These kind of primordial urges. And so that if we're trying to run our practice on an elevated level, but we don't learn how to train ourselves to deal with those basic fundamental urges towards procreation, preservation, aggression, protection of the body, territory, and so forth, these very basic forces that run in our lives, in our hearts, then it's very difficult to truly develop the higher mind. And so this quality of contentment and gratitude for whatever is there to support us, that an ease of living. And even if one is a layperson, it doesn't reflect just as a monastic, but even these are principles that are applicable for everybody. Then what we're doing is training the heart to be wise and skillful, even in these areas where it's sort of in the pre-verbal, pre-cognitive zones of experience, where there is where it's to do with, as you notice, it with the requisites, or to do with protection from the weather, they're to do with food, they're to do with shelter, covering for the body, the health of the body. These are pretty basic, primordial aspects of life, things that every living creature has to take care of, and where the self-centered urges are extraordinarily strong, preserving the body, getting something to eat, finding shelter. Even the most basic, tiny little creatures learn how to do all of this. So that to train the heart to not be guided by selfish concerns, not to always be wanting to get more, or wanting to get stuff for me, or more concerned about my space than somebody else's, what about me? It's my half of the room. My sisters are coming to visit in April, and they also shared a room in the farmhouse that we first lived in. And my younger sister, to her a continual embarrassment, remembers very vividly how, you know, she would not allow my elder sister to cross over her half of the room. It's like the demarcation was so fierce. It's my half. You can't step a foot in here. Not a toe will cross into my half of the room. So we're training the heart to know those kind of urges, the pull towards getting it for me, concern about me, and to be content, to not be dominated by those worldly concerns, but to be able to cut through that, to establish an ease of heart and a quality of gratitude. That whatever the clothing happens to be, if your robes are a bit of a weird color, or your clothing is a bit sort of out of date or out of fashion, well, it's good enough. It covers the body, keeps, you know, the cold out in the chilly weather, and keeps the sun off in the heat. A shelter is good enough. It doesn't have to be the perfect kuti in the perfect spot, or the perfect house with the perfect view and the perfect heating system, cooling system. And that when we find that place of good enough, that it doesn't, it's a place of peacefulness, the podi in Thai, the attitude of it's okay, it's good enough, it suffices, it's a good enough body, it's a good enough food, in the way of food to sustain energy, it's good enough in the way of shelter. So the point, one of the main points also of training the heart in this quality of contentment, gratitude, relating to the requisites, relating to our sort of life-preserving urges with equanimity and with stability, and to learn to be at ease with whatever shows up. This is not just a virtue in and of itself, but it's a basis for meditation. And this is, in a way, the main point that Ajahn Sumedho was making when he was talking about this at the meeting, is that when we establish that heart of genuine gratitude, contentment, and it's not fussy or picky or needing things to be a particular way, then that provides a wonderful basis for meditation. Because if we've really trained the heart to be at ease with different circumstances, whether we happen to be a bit hot or a bit cold or a bit hungry or a bit full, in good health or poor health, that the heart does not get disturbed by that. There's a kind of settledness and a groundedness and a fundamental ease that we experience, and the establishment of the meditation, the development of concentration, of insight, the training of the heart just to rest in the pure awareness of knowing, the Buddha, the Buddha mind, the Buddha knowing, is much easier to do, because the forces that would pull the attention away from that are greatly diminished. By cultivating this quality of contentment and gratitude, then we're reducing the causes whereby that kind of turbulence of the heart would be exacerbated. Would be made worse, made more intense. Also, taking the precepts and this is one prayer evening, the half moon night, and people just before the talk took the eight precepts, and it's a part of our monastic cycle of events. So, every fortnight, every week, we reflect on our commitment, our training. We remember the precepts and recommit to that standard. But it's and also along with, say, the reflections on the requisites, then the precepts are also a similar set of structures that we employ to help support that quality of contentment, of ease, of not being needy, not chasing after the desire objects, running away from the aversion objects, not creating causes of confusion in ourselves, not creating regret, acting violently in terms of the first precept, not acting greedily or dishonestly in terms of the second, not pursuing sexual desire or sensuality in the terms of the third precept, not generating dishonesty or harshness in our speech and communications, sustaining mindfulness with respect to the fifth precept, being restrained in the way that we eat. Again, the last three precepts are all renunciant precepts, just like the third one when it becomes a brahmacharya. Refraining from any kind of sexual activity, that's a renunciant precept. Similarly, the last three, vikala bhojana, nachagita, and uchasayana, mahasayana, these last three precepts, refraining from eating at inappropriate times, refraining from singing, dancing, beautification, entertainment, adornment, and so on, and refrainment from overindulgence in sleep, lying in a high and luxurious sleeping place, refraining from four-poster beds with a sea of downy cushions and pillows to float away on. That these are renunciate precepts in a similar way, that to support that samana sanya, that what do you really need? Do you really need a whole fancy bed, or can you just make do with a thermarest or a bit of carpet and a folded up jacket for a pillow? What do you really need? In terms of food, just confining it just to the morning time, or just one meal a day, just to establish that as a basic standard, just fueling up the body, stoking the engine, fill her up, and then run for the day on the full tank, and then when it gets empty, next day fill her up again. Very simple. In not seeking happiness just through entertainment or just distraction through keeping the senses occupied or spending an unnecessary amount of time beautifying and concerned about our appearance and our hairdo and or lack of hairdo, changing our hairdo. Just to be able to look at that dimension in a very functional and simple way. So these are supporting that aspect that we can feel totally at peace, content, fulfilled, without having a whole battery of hardware to support that. We don't need to have the right kind of food, the chosen kinds of food, perfect kinds of food at precise times of the day, exactly what we want when we want it. We don't have to have, we don't have to look a particular way. Don't have to be concerned about our appearance. Got basic grooming, concerns taken care of, but then the rest is we don't have to be worried about, you know, whether people find us attractive or unattractive. It's, we don't have to burn energy being concerned about that. So that these are our basic ways the sila, then they establish that same quality of removing the causes of disturbance, so that when we act in a gentle ways, honest ways, ungreedy ways, then we are establishing a very firm basis for the practice. There's a wonderful teaching that the Buddha gave, where he outlines how liberation is a natural consequence of a whole chain of causes and effects that begins with establishing the heart in sila, establishing our way of conduct in virtue. He says, for one who practices sila, there is no need for them to think, may my heart be free from remorse. Vipatisara in Pali. Then there's no need to think, may the heart be free from remorse, because it's completely natural for one who lives virtuously for the heart to be free from remorse. You don't have to wish it to happen, because that's the natural result. If the precepts are kept, then you're not doing things that you have to regret. QED. For one who is free from remorse, then it's natural for them to feel satisfied, pamudita, or to feel at ease. For one who feels at ease, it's natural for them to experience joy, piti, rapture. For one who experiences rapture, who feels piti, then it's natural for them to be relaxed, to be physically relaxed. I think samahita kayasa, I think, is the Pali for that. The body is relaxed. If the heart is joyful and satisfied, at ease, then the body relaxes. And then he says, for one whose body is relaxed, then it's natural to feel contentment, sukha, happiness. You don't have to wish it, that if there is that physical relaxation, then there is this quality of sukha. And so in this respect, just these qualities like of pamudita, which is related to the word pamuja, for joy or ease, being satisfied, quality of sukha, happiness or contentment, ease of the relaxation of the body, these all come from this basic qualities of restraint. And that contentment, then, as he says, one who experiences sukha does not have to wish, may my mind be concentrated, because it's completely natural for one who experiences sukha for their mind to be concentrated. You don't have to generate samadhi. Because if the heart is really content, then it easily focuses on a single object. It's quite ordinary and straightforward for that. Because the forces whereby the attention would be drawn away from that, what would make the object sort of agitated, mobile, and the attention hard to settle on it, those causes are not present. And then he says, for one who is concentrated, there is no need for them to wish, may the knowledge and vision of the way things are arise, because it's completely natural in one who's concentrated, that yathabhutang jnana dasanam, knowledge and vision of the way things are, will arise. Or insight, vipassana, it's the same basic insight will arise. And for one in whom the knowledge and vision of the way things are arises, there's no need for them to wish, may I generate detachment or disenchantment nipita. Because it's, if one who sees the way things are, it's completely natural for them to be disenchanted with the sense world, to let go, to not be entangled in thoughts of self and other, to be driven by loves and hates, attractions and aversions with the sense world. There's a disenchantment. The spell is broken. The enchantment is broken. So you don't need to think, may I let go, because that's automatic. And finally he says, for one who experiences disenchantment, nipita, then there's no need for them to think, may I experience the knowledge and vision of liberation, vimuti jnana dasana. Because when there is nipita, when there is that disenchantment, then it's completely natural for that person to then experience vimuti, liberation. The heart knows that it is liberated. So this maps out in this very neat and complete way how, based on these fundamental principles of say sila, and then establishing contentment with also with this like development of the reflection on our possessions, our needs, our dependencies, and cultivating a lack of neediness, an independence, a non-dependency on things, learning to really know where our preferences, our discontents get parked, you know, where you've got to have things a certain way. I can't manage without my cup of tea, or I can't manage without, you know, my car, or I can't manage without this, that, or the other. Or that, you know, I can give up, you know, I don't mind food, is no big deal at all. Food's not a problem. Yeah. Don't mind about that. But, you know, I am not going to share my space, you know. No concerns about physical needs or health care or whether there's medicine to take. Okay, if there isn't anything to take, that's okay. But, But if anyone tries to to mess around with my cupboard, if anybody moves any of my things, you know, this, we can experience sort of volcanic rage, a sort of territoriality. There's that famous book of, I think it's on business management, called Who Moved My Cheese? I don't know what the book is about, but I know the Who Moved My Cheese feeling. Where's it gone? Who's done that? So it might be different things that we are unaware of, but if we train ourselves in a rounded way and learn from each other, be ready to receive feedback from each other, you know, the people that we live with, the people we share our lives with, our friends and companions, and we get to see where those areas of dependency, those discontentments are, you know, where we have to have things a particular way in terms of our material living situation, our possessions, our sense of control over our health or our mobility, you know, that we maybe think we're really ascetic and that we don't need anything, but if somebody gets in the way of my travel plans or what I choose to do with my life, I'll stand back. You know, so we might be thinking of ourselves as very ascetic and, like, you know, very, very bare bones, and, you know, extremely modest and need very, very few needs. But then what happens is the things where we're really stuck, you know, say like that, you know, the freedom to move around and make your own choices and not submit to the routines or choices of others, that, you know, that we're not noticing as some kind of high octane resistance to that, this kind of ferocious, you know, force wells up in us that says, well, sod that. I'm going to do my thing. And then go off and do our thing, but do it in a very ascetic and completely, you know, five-star renunciate way. You know, I'm speaking from experience. This is the way we operate, so that we need to learn, you know, where are the dependencies? What are the things that we feel we've got to have? Is it my book supply? Is it my mobility? Is it my food? Is it my medicines? Is it my companions? Is it the weather? And just looking, casting around our gaze and learning to see where our real weaknesses, our dependencies and discontents are. And then aiming the attention at those spots, being ready to learn. What's it like if you haven't got anything to read? What's it like if you can't go where you want? What's it like when you just take the food according to other protocols other than what is most pleasing? You just sort of one spoon from each bowl and go back to your place. Sit down and eat it. What happens? And so then we use these situations and to learn where our weaknesses are, so that we're not just slaloming around the areas of where we're and avoiding the areas of deep attachment, and just developing our slaloming ability, that we just not. You know, we can very easily, very neatly maneuver around those and not touch them or even address them or look at them. But if we really want to be free, if we want to arrive at that quality of vimutti and genuinely know the Dhamma, then those areas of weakness and dependency, those discontents, need to be really known, understood, and let go of. To train the heart to relinquish those, to release those. And then we find there's a direct relationship that, as Lumpur was describing, that the more fully content we are, the more there's a basic gratitude and the heart really is at ease with the circumstances of the world and our life and how things are, then the practice unfolds as neatly as in that little sutta of the Buddha's. It's just an unrolling ribbon, just unfurls, and one thing leads easily to another. But without those basic prerequisites, if those aren't in place, then the unfurling is not quite as sort of smooth and fluid. It's more sort of knotted and snarled, and the ribbon is kind of a bit stuck. It's a sort of some gluey patches, you know, sticking the ribbon together. Can't quite get past the early sections of the unfolding. So these are some thoughts to consider for this evening and for these for reflection. And may they be useful. Anyone?